This program is sponsored by Blazing Grace Ministries.
This radio program is PG-13. Parents strongly caution some material may be inappropriate for children under the age of 13. Send me free. Of the chains holding me.
Is anybody out there hearing me? Send me free.
Jesus' mission was to comfort those who mourn, bind up the brokenhearted, proclaim liberty to captives, and open prison doors for those who are bound. For those who want more than status quo Christianity has to offer, Blazing Grace Radio begins now. And here is your host, Mike Janung.
Hey, Mike Janung here. Welcome back to Blazing Grace Radio. Thank you for joining us on this journey of life. And today it's supposed to be 116 degrees here in Phoenix, so it's going to be a hot journey today. And a couple announcements. First off, we have an opportunity to do a video series in the United Kingdom. So in the UK, we've been going there the last 5 years, and they've told us quite a few times, I've heard, that there are very few Christian ministries helping people with porn and sex addiction and adultery there. And so an opportunity is open to where there's an organization, a Christian organization, that would help us create a video series. They found from doing their research, this would be the best way to reach the UK churches and Christians there. And they recommended creating a video series and then getting it out to the UK to their more than 70,000 churches there. So this would not only include creating the video series, but also the promotion and getting the word out to churches all over the country. So the cost to do this is $15,000. So if you'd like to help us with the cost to do this, it's a wonderful opportunity, and I see it as a mission field for what we do, helping people overcome these issues. So again, if you'd like to help us, we're a 501c3 nonprofit organization, and you can go to the Donate Us page at blazinggrace.org. And one last thing, we have people contacting us from New Zealand to the UK and other countries telling us that they listen to the broadcast. So I just want to say hello to you and thank you. And I know that people are stumbling onto us through Spotify and other means. And so thank you for joining us. So part of what we try to do on this show is move into the real world areas that people are hurting with and struggling with. And one of them that I have brought up before is suicide. And I've discussed on this program how, as a teen, after being molested, I was very dangerously close to taking my own life at the time. And it's a huge problem now. It's growing, and it's now the number two killer of youth behind accidental death. So this is an issue that, and there, I see articles from time to time, a pastor's wife committed suicide recently. I see pastors and other pastors' wives, articles with us who have ended their lives and others. And I have a good friend who just told me she spent some time with a friend of hers who were sobbing her eyes out because she had lost her son to that. So today I have a guest who can give some weight to this issue, and her name is Linda Crocht. She spent her early years in a small town in Wisconsin. Linda was raised as a Catholic and became a born-again Christian in her teens. After she graduated from Oral Roberts University, Linda met Scott at church, and they were married and then had two kids. Their family moved to Colorado Springs, where she worked as assistant to the children's pastor at Rocky Mountain Calvary for 13 years. And this is how I know her. I met her back then when we were in Colorado. Linda has now worked as a flight attendant for 13 years. And 4.5 years ago, Linda's husband, Scott, took his own life. So, Linda, welcome to the program.
Hello, Mike. Nice to talk to you. And I hope I'm some help here to your listeners.
Well, thank you for being willing to share this. So let's jump right in and have you share your story.
Okay, I will, and just interrupt me if I start talking too long or something. I want to share a couple things just first before I get into the details. Scott took his own life, committed suicide, whatever you want to call it. I wanted to explain that before we experienced, you know, his depression and anxiety and all that, I was like maybe others feeling that depression is really just something you got to get over with. It's all in your head and, you know, medicine's not really good for it. And so that was my thinking. Also, Scott had shared with me, and I had kind of forgotten about, we were married 29 years, and this depression really changed his personality and life. And so for 29, he had told me when we were dating that he was, you know, had struggled with some depression and never suicidal, but just depression. He had done drugs as a high schooler, maybe out of high school. And, you know, I'm dating, I'm in love, and, you know, he was over it. But I was reminded of it just right after he died. I was reading a book that we had written to each other, kind of like love letters to each other, like a little book and, you know, all the mushy stuff. And I had written in one of them, "I'm glad you're not depressed anymore." So I do have to say that I think there's some genetic link a little bit at times. And I think he had shared that his grandmother had some treatment for mental illness, you know, long, long time ago and been committed or something. So I think there's a little bit of that there. But and also our journey was pretty short when this all kind of started. It was like April and he died in November. So like 7 months where I know, you know, I have friends that their, you know, spouses struggle with depression and, you know, they're a functioning depressed person. You know, they go to work, but then when they come home, they just don't have any more. So some people deal with it a lot more, and I really feel for them because that's hard. Mine was, it felt like a long time, but it was fairly short, really. But, and one other thing, just, we did not have a perfect marriage, as everybody that's married knows. It's tough, you know, two different personalities, and it's hard. I'm trying to make it clear what I'm trying to say here, but I'm kind of a controlling person, and I feel like I wish I would have been a better wife. And, you know, I was aware of it, and he told me, and, you know, he had his problems, I had my problems, and we were always working on it. A couple times got bad enough that he talked about divorce and, you know, considered getting a lawyer. So I thank God that he didn't, and that I was able to be with him and help him when he was struggling. And I'm not really saying that contributed to, you know, the suicidal thought. I just wish, just when you know, when something happens, you look back, and I think that he just, there was an underlying negativity or depressed type thinking in his life, or I'm a really hopeful, positive, energetic person. And I just think he was really good at overcoming it. But then later on, I don't know what happened, but I just feel like if in 29 years of marriage, I'd been a better support, then maybe, you know, something might've been different, but you cannot blame yourself. When someone commits suicide, a lot of times it's a shock, and you can't, you know, unless you're a bullying person and you're telling someone to commit suicide, you can't blame yourself. And I certainly wasn't doing that. So I don't do that, but I just want to set the stage that, you know, we didn't not have a perfect marriage, and it's part of our journey too. And that over time, because, you know, we struggled with marriage, you know, and kids and disagreeing about raising the kids or whatever. And then, I became a flight attendant, and so then I'm away from home. And of course, then he's wondering about, you know, just trust issues when you're away and you're with other people and working with other people and staying in hotels. And I assured him everything's fine. And, you know, there was faithfulness completely on both sides. Faithfulness, I think I said. There was that aspect to our relationship, you know, where he had to learn to get used to me being away. And Anyways, we lived kind of like independent lives. You know, we did a lot together. We did stuff with the kids, but when the kids were grown, so my kids are both grown and married now. He just kind of did his own thing. He would go to meetups and go biking and go have coffee and da da da. And I did my pro-life stuff and my church stuff and my work, you know, so we lived very independent lives, and it's just going to show the contrast when he was depressed, how it completely changes a person. Cause I'll get to that later. So all that to, start out with, in April of 2019, he came to me and, you know, said, "I'm having trouble sleeping." Well, he always was a good sleeper. He needed his sleep. He liked his sleep. He was very faithful to get to bed like at 10, and he woke up like without an alarm for work at 6. So sleeping was not a problem.
How old was Scott at that point?
How old is he?
How old was he?
He's in his 50s, late 50s. He's 60. I think he was 60.
Okay.
Yeah. And so, you know, yeah, you're thinking, okay, maybe it's an age thing. You know, there's some kind of health reason, right? Because he sleeps well. So we went to the doctor, blood test, you know, we're thinking thyroid, whatever, you know, just, and he would, you know, sleep in another room, just to try to get sleep. He'd be playing Bible, you know, just somebody reading the Bible, and we're praying and asking people to pray. And a lot of this we told my family, because my side of the family, my parents and sister, are believers. He has a lot of siblings, but none of them are believers. So he didn't share a lot. I think he told his brother that he was depressed, but we never shared anything about suicide attempts or any of that. So that was a real shock for his family, but he didn't want to tell them, and I was honoring that. But so because of my thinking that, well, he actually did go to our family doctor, and his family doctor said, "You're depressed," and gave him some medicine. Well, he didn't want to take it because of his past drug use, and I agreed. I'm like, "You don't need medicine, depression. We can figure this out. We're going to get over this." So it just sat on the counter. Later he did take it, but we were doing puzzles and exercising. We're like, you know, you got to keep your biking up, you know, doing walks, reading, praying, you know, we just feel like we tried everything. And he had, I also have to say that he had retired, and he had been retired about a year. But that had been something he had been talking about for many years. I didn't really agree with it. I'm like, wow, that seems young to be retired at 60. I love my job. You know, it was a new career for me. I love being a flight attendant. It's been a dream job. And he liked it, the benefits of it. He got to fly out and see his friends and my family and his family. And he was flying all over, and he'd join me on overnight sometimes. But he finally took the jump and retired. And, you know, he was very financially frugal like me, and he had paid off the house. And he's like, "Do you like your job? You really like your job? Do you want to keep working? How long do you want to keep working?" And he planned that we could live off my salary. So he retired, and he was enjoying it, it seemed, and doing everything like usual, and having lunch with his buddy, who I won't say first name, but this family was a great help during our journey, and still I'm good friends with him. And this is his best friend who he would have lunch with and hike with. So what was just so weird that I could really start to notice something's weird is he always drank coffee. He quit drinking coffee. He wasn't on his phone as much because he was always on his phone, and he was always bike riding, and he quit bike riding. And I've heard from a psychologist or psychiatrist, I'm not exactly sure the exact title, but that somebody, it's my neighbor who, after he committed suicide, was talking with me, that when people are depressed, a lot of times they amplify little things. So, like, you know, he's 60 years old, right? We're falling apart. We got aches and pains. And he'd be like, "Listen, Linda, listen to this." And he'd move his shoulder, and, you know, had a little crack or something. You know, he thought something was wrong with his shoulder, and I couldn't hear anything. I'm like, "Scott, you're perfectly fine. It's not that big of a deal." And he'd be like, "Oh, I can't ride my bike. It's something's broken on it." And, you know, we got it fixed really, really cheap. You know, I'm like, "Well, let's go get it fixed." And, just, everything was a little problem became a really big problem, you know, something that he would never been anxious about before. He's getting anxious about, and the sleep, he's like, I can't sleep. And, you know, he was getting about 6 hours of sleep, which he needed more, but a lot of people live on, I practically do, you know, so, amplifying the little things. And so, you know, I'm just kind of denying that it's depression. And so end of June, our church was doing vacation Bible school, and I always help with that. So I was helping with it and trying to kind of help him, you know, trying to be with him a lot. But when I'm away, give him a job to do, you know, have him something to do in the yard or whatever, which he was always good at doing all that stuff. He's a smart guy. Everybody loves him. His workers loved him. He's very personable and very handy at working on the car and everything around the house, you know, so he's going to completely change. Just didn't have a lot of motivation and wasn't hanging out and going to his meetup groups. So the last day of vacation Bible school, the Friday, he would sleep in the basement because our basement's a lot cooler in the summer. And so he wasn't getting up, and I went down there, and feels like he's hemming and hawing and acting like he's got something to tell me. And he finally tells me that 2 days prior, he had gone in the garage and turned on the exhaust and was going to, you know, hopefully die with car exhaust. But he had only stayed out there like a minute or two, changed his mind, turned it off. And so for 2 days, he hadn't told me that. And so I'm like, okay, well, this is serious. And, brought him, you know, I'm like, oh, I have to help with the VBS. They need me. They're counting on me. I brought him to church with me and had the pastors talk to him and pray with him and gave him something to do to help out. And then I'm just thinking, you know, what am I going to do? This is new to me, you know, depression, suicide. Oh my gosh, can't believe it. And another thing too about the amplifying things, so that set the stage because he did that. Everything he tried to do, any reading, or he didn't like reading before, but he was trying, or I would read to him, and we were trying to read some fun stuff, you know, true stories, inspiring stuff. And he'd say, oh, you know, I could have hurt you with the exhaust coming in the house. I'd be like, Scott, no, you didn't. You didn't, you're not trying to hurt me. I didn't even smell anything, and da da da. But he just could not let that go for all the way till his death. He just thought, you know, again, the amplifying and thinking a little thing is a big thing. And so this is great with my job. I got intermittent leave, which is very nice. I could take leave as needed. It's kind of intended for people that maybe have cancer treatment and they can't work 1 week, but are fine the next or whatever. So sometimes I would be home, take off, and then sometimes I would do shorter trips or have friends try to be around him more. My son lives here in town, grown son, he would help, and or he would join with me if it looked like there were seats on the plane to fly standby and be with me at work on my overnights, or I'd pick up trips that I thought he could do that. So one trip we got very delayed coming back home, and so he was home alone for longer hours than we planned. And when I got home, he was just a mess, anxious. Just he was just constantly cracking his knuckles, which he had never done, and you know, talking again about that he had ruined his brain with the car exhaust. And, you know, we had studied it, and they're like, no, you were just out there a minute or two. It didn't do anything. But he was just so anxious. I didn't know what else to do. I'm like, okay, in the morning, we'll go see a doctor. We'll go do something. Well, that night, we were both going to sleep in the basement for the coolness, and I was so tired, I went to bed, and he didn't. I woke up later, real early in the morning, and he was up in our bedroom, and he was just an anxious mess. And anxiety is just so difficult to, you know, you just feel like the person is just a jittery, and they're going to do something, and you don't know how to calm them down. And I mean, God was good through us all this. We, you know, because of the marital difficulties before, we weren't praying together. You know, we went to church, but we weren't praying together. We weren't reading the Bible together. And now we were, and he was, it's bad because it wasn't him. But he was following me around like a puppy dog. I mean, I was the one that had to tell him what to do, you know, here, you know, let's do this. And it just shows the contrast that it was not my Scott. It was not him. And, you know, I'm having to make decisions for him. And so that morning, because it was so bad, I just thought, you know, nobody's open, doctor's office aren't open. I'm like, we're just going to have to go to the ER. And he had said he'd almost went there himself. But so we went to the ER. Well, if your listeners don't know, once you mention suicide and you're at a hospital, they're going to commit you, or at least here in Colorado Springs. But it's probably more states like that. So he was admitted to a psychiatric facility in Colorado Springs, and it was probably the worst 2 weeks of my life, because I'm kind of denying that he's depressed. I almost wasn't very nice to the staff because one, you know, nurse called me and said he is severely depressed. I'm like, my husband is not depressed. That is just not him. Something is going on. We got to figure out what it is. And I understand what psychiatric hospitals want to do. They're trying to save someone's life, and it's usually 3 days. But he was in there 2 weeks, and it's just, you get to go see him for 1 hour, and you're not really supposed to touch. You can do like a hug, and then you got to sit across the table, and they, you know, you don't get much sleep. There's a lot of noise, and they don't have a lot of activities, and it's classes trying to get you to, you know, for exercises to try to think positive or think on good things or re-change your thinking. But he's just like, I'm not getting sleep. I can't think. And they, you know, in the morning, they assess you, you know, they ask you the same questions. And, you know, if you say something, that's how they adjust your medication. So he was put on medication and so many different kinds. I thought I would never, ever forget the name of these. And I've, you know, thank God 4.5 years later, you know, I've forgotten them. But it's so real at the moment. You just think, and we were writing everything down, how much sleep you got and all this, and so much more afterwards too, to try to keep track of it so we could wean off of some of these medicines. But he was on sleep meds and depression meds. And it, to me, it just all seemed like it's the psychiatric field is a guessing game. It's just guessing a medicine. If it works, if it doesn't, then you have to slowly wean off of it and try another. And, you know, I don't want to slam psychiatric profession, but I've just learned that the mental health field is, there's so much unknown, and there's so much that is discouraging, frustrating, perplexing.
We've got about a minute and a half left, so
okay.
I'm going to wrap up this first show soon, but I do want to interject, and I've had experiences mm-hmm. and in the psych ward myself back in 2008, and I will affirm what you say, that the mental health field is a guessing game, and when they guess right, well, it can work, but when they guess wrong, the consequences can be disastrous. So we're going to continue this conversation with Linda next week and get more of the story. But so, Linda, 30 seconds. Talk to the person yep. right now who might be considering ending their life.
You know, like everybody says, you do have to get somebody else involved. I'm not sure calling 1-800 suicide hotline is the best, but a close friend that you can trust, because that will help. You need to have somebody around you. And that's the first step, somebody that you know and trust, because you got to stop that pit of falling into, that's the solution, because suicide is not the solution. Suicide's not good. I'll share later, God knows, though. He knows what you're thinking. He knows your heart. He knows your pit you're in. But we don't want to let the devil win, and the devil doesn't win. But God is good, and I'm going to share more of that board. So you got to lean on God. But
amen. So thank you, Linda, for coming on and sharing your story with us. I imagine, I can only imagine it must be painful. So we will continue this conversation with Linda next week, and I encourage you to join in and listen then. So see you next time.
Do you want to be free?
Blazing Grace is a nonprofit international ministry for the sexually broken and the spouse. Please visit us at blazinggrace.org for information on Mike Janung's books, groups, counseling, or to have Mike speak at your organization. You can email us at email@blazinggrace.org or call our office in Chandler, Arizona at 719-888-5144. Again, visit us at blazinggrace.org. Email us at email@blazinggrace.org or call the office at 719-888-5144.
This program was sponsored by Blazing Grace Ministries.